Now, there are many places in the world where you can say you're on the divide between two oceans. And although you might not think it, one of them is here in Russia's northern Arkhangelsk region in the Kinozora National Park. And today, we're not going to let the weather stop us from taking a deep dive into its rich ecosystem. Vasily, the great watershed of two oceans, it's certainly a very epic name, but is this really where the Atlantic and the Arctic oceans meet? Because we are quite far from both of them at the moment.
It's true that it's called the Great Watershed, and it separates the Arctic and the Atlantic oceans. Since time immemorial, there have been two lakes here divided by this sandy ridge. Water from this one flows through a system of rivers and lakes into the Onega River, which flows into the White Sea and onto the Arctic Ocean. This lake on the other side is also connected through a system of rivers and lakes to Lake Onega, then Lake Ladoga, the Neva River, the Baltic Sea, and eventually the Atlantic. These two lakes are not connected in any way. There are no waterways linking them or anything like that. Their waters are separated. That's why they called it a watershed between the two oceans.
And how did it form and how long ago?
The watershed was formed about 12,000 years ago, as the great Scandinavian glacier was receding. According to geologists, the melting glacier created a river that used to flow across this land northwards. The river brought this sand and pebbles. As a result, the lakes, which had also originated from the glacier, became divided, and the present-day system emerged.
But I've heard there's also a more mythical version of events. What can you tell me about that?
There is also a legend, that's right. Let me tell you. It's said there was a water spirit, or Vodyanoi, who had a daughter. Two other water spirits, one of whom was the master of Kinozora, wanted her hand in marriage. The Kinozora spirit was the first to propose, but was turned down. The other had better luck. The Kinozora spirit angrily returned to his lake and blocked the road with huge boulders. Since then, Kinozora has been separated from the other lake. I told you about the geological history of this place, but as we walk down the watershed, the story and row between the water spirits is clearly about two lakes, two seas, and two oceans.
Vasily, just how many lakes are there in this national park?
There are indeed many lakes here. The proximity of Karelia and the glacier was probably a factor. There are thought to be over 200 in Kinozora Park. It's hard to give the exact number. Some lakes are very small, really tiny. Kinozora is different from the rest. While the others are glacial lakes, Kinozora was formed because of a fracture and is about 100 meters deep in some areas. The smaller lakes are only about 12 meters deep. Another interesting thing about Kinozora is its very picturesque and broken shoreline with many islands, villages, and churches. Those villages were once full of life because of the busy waterways, the only available transport routes here. This sculpture here depicts a spirit. It took a battering over the winter, poor guy. It looked in better condition last year. We're going to the windmill, so we're supposed to ask him for permission. These water spirits are supposed to be the friends of millers. Visitors should ask, "May we go to the windmill, kind sir?" He says that's okay. Let's go then.
Excellent. Is it true that they used to collect pearls from these lakes, Vasily?
You mean river pearls? Those were harvested in rivers, not lakes. It was an important industry around here as recently as the 19th century. Local rivers had populations of pearl mussels, and many locals made a living collecting them. It would have been inappropriate for a wealthy woman not to have a river pearl necklace. Due to overfishing, though, those populations were destroyed towards the end of the 19th century. You can only find river mussels in remote spots these days, if at all.
A unique trail lies in the heart of Kinozora National Park. It's called the Ant Path, and it takes you deep into the forest with giant anthills lining the way, each a thriving, bustling community. Let's get a glimpse into the lives of these fascinating creatures. Sophia, we've not been walking in the forest for that long, and I can already see quite a few anthills. There's one there, there's one over there. Just how many are there in this forest?
There are over 120 anthills in this forest.
120?
Mm-hmm.
So why are there so many anthills in this forest? I can see one just there as well. Can we have a closer look?
Yes, yeah? Sure.
How close can we get?
As close as you want.
Okay, well, you go first then. So why are there so many in this forest? What's so special?
The environment here is great for ants. Trees in the forest protect ants from adverse factors. The forest also provides ideal humidity. There's enough food for these ants, too. That's why they thrive here.
And are we disturbing them by being so close?
Not really, even if we're stepping on them a little bit.
Okay, well, that's certainly a good sign. So what would happen if we took a cross-section of the anthill, Sophia? What would we see inside?
We would see chambers, some filled with ants, others with larvae and eggs. There are corridors between these galleries, as they're called. Actually, what we see from the outside is not the whole anthill. They can be 1.5 meters high and also go as deep as 1.5 or 2 meters underground.
So how long would it take for the ants to build an anthill of this size?
A few years.
Really?
Yes, really. It's a lengthy process, and it's not like all the ants just go ahead and start building these huge ant hills. As a rule, there are a few families. By the way, we talk about ant families. They consist of males and females. The females lay eggs and produce worker ants. Several can be producing eggs at the same time. That makes the little families a magnet for other ants, which helps them grow an ant hill.
Yeah, I think they like me. Or maybe not.
Maybe not.
Well, should we move on before I get eaten by these ants,
sure.
Sophia?
Yes.
So how big can these anthills get, Sophia?
Ants don't build huge anthills around here, so they don't reach more than 1.5 meters in height. They're usually these round little hillocks. Other more exotic ant species can build anthills in entirely different shapes, like more conical ones.
What can you tell me about how these ants organize their societies, Sophia?
They have families. Each family has a winged female, a winged male, or even many males, because one female can mate with several males. It carries their sperm for years, sometimes up to 20 years, and uses it to reproduce. They collectively form a nest where each worker ant, who is an incompletely developed female, has certain specializations. Some forage for food, others dig or take care of the eggs and larvae, and so on.
And how do they know which role they have? Is it given to them when they're born? Do they develop it? Can they change roles, Sophia?
When they're born, they don't have a specific role yet. It all depends on the care they're given by nanny ants. If the family needs it, the nannies will raise more queens or more foragers, whatever is required. They can change their task specialization during their life cycle. If many foragers have died, some nannies may turn into foragers or vice versa.
Well, here's a philosophical question for you. Would you draw any similarities to how the ants organize their societies with how humans, people, organize their societies?
I believe we could draw some parallels here, yes. Because we, as people, always look for patterns in nature, as we try to find meaning in everything we encounter and see our own reflection in nature. So, yes, why not?
How do the ants know what they're supposed to be doing at a certain time?
As ants mature, they're first assigned the role of a nanny. Nannies then graduate to doing nest work, such as cleaning or removing dead ants from the anthill.
Okay, so they have a graveyard somewhere?
No, they don't have a graveyard. They just leave them outside to prevent the spread of disease. Later, they become ants who venture outside the anthill. The oldest and most experienced ants, those who have traveled extensively outside the nest, become majors, who concentrate here on top and supervise the rest. The higher-ranking ants can control the lower-ranking ones and give them orders. They can either carry a subordinate ant to the place of its work or use pheromones to leave a trail and indicate where a worker ant should go. These are not the only methods. There are more.
Okay. And how old does an ant live? What's the life cycle of an ant? Is it weeks, months?
Weeks, yes. The queen, however, who produces offspring can live up to 20 years. She has a very long life cycle.
Are these ants territorial, Sophia? Do they compete for resources with the other anthills? I mean, obviously, they're not too keen on us being too close to them for too long.
Yes, they do protect themselves and their anthills. You can say that different types of ants compete with each other. Some ants from a more powerful anthill can make forays into neighboring anthills to steal larvae and pupae, bring them into their own anthill, and raise them for themselves.
Wow.
To meet the needs of their own anthill. The females of the less powerful anthills are also prized trophies, since they can be used to replace the queen. The queen can die due to various reasons, but queens from lesser anthills in the neighborhood are a reserve for breeding.
So these tiny ants, these maggots that have been taken from one anthill to another and they grow up in the other one, they don't realize that they belong to a different family?
They do understand that they belong to certain families, and sometimes they run away before going back to their queen to take care of her needs, such as care for larvae or defend her. So they eventually wind up back at their anthill, because ants always obey their superiors in the hierarchy and execute their orders signaled by pheromones.
Vasily, what types of fish are most abundant in these lakes?
There are some characteristic species here. Our signature local fish is the European cisco, a small type of white fish. You can only catch it in the fall when it forms schools during the spawning season. Then everyone around here becomes a fisherman. There's also a fishing competition that we hold in spring.
And do you take part in the competitions?
I don't anymore because it's a little embarrassing these days. When the youngest fishermen are 6 or even 3 years old. Besides, I'm not much of a fisherman myself.
Would be embarrassing being beaten by a 5-year-old.
Sure, it would be embarrassing to lose. I'll just pretend I'm too cool for that sort of thing.
We've also decided to try our hand at fishing in the pristine Kinozora waters, under the expert guidance of Konstantin Bogolyubov, or Uncle Kostya, as he's known around these parts. Konstantin, nice to meet you. Nice to meet you. I've got my wellies on. I'm ready to go fishing. Let's go. So you've got your fishing rod and everything. Can I take something? Let's go. So I've heard that the best time to go fishing is at sunrise or sunset, which is about now. Why is that, Konstantin?
Predators are harder to see in the dark, so that's when predatory fish prefer to hunt and are more likely to take your bait. In summer, it's also cooler around these times, so fish are more active.
And I've also heard about that you have to feed the water to ensure a good catch. What can you tell me about that ritual or custom?
Some may throw a piece of bread into the lake. Others may say a spell. There's also this notion that you can't take fish with you when you go fishing, like canned fish or a fish pie. You shouldn't bring those along. Or hard-boiled chicken eggs. They're supposedly also bad luck. Those are just superstitions, of course.
Poveria, that's it. It's just a bit of superstition. Can I help you?
Sure. Here we go. A little more. Let me turn it. Whatever works for you, yes. You can do it sideways, sure. Here you go. Close the bale. Reel it in. That's it. Nice.
So we've got our fish that we've caught, Constantine, and we're going to make ucha fish soup. Where do we start?
Where do we start? We'll boil some water first.
So, Constantine, can you make ucha from any type of fish?
You can use any type of fish. You can mix them up as well, whatever you have to hand. Roach, rough, anything. You want to use similar-sized fish, though, because bigger fish take longer to cook. Otherwise, you can make what's called double or triple ucha. That's when they cook small fry first to make the broth savory. Take it out and throw it away before adding bigger fish.
Well, sounds like quite a complicated process. And I've heard that people have different secrets to making the ucha taste delicious. Some people add lemon juice, some people add vodka. What's your secret?
I don't normally add anything. I just use the basic ingredients. Potatoes, onions, fish and bay leaves. That's it. If you don't have bay leaves, that's also fine. Peter, will you add some firewood?
Mm-hmm.
And I'll peel the onions. How many pieces? We just need a little pile here. You can put them across one another. Here, like that. Over there, Peter. I'm not a chef, of course, but still. Let me show you. Now turn it.
And how long does it take to boil the soup, to cook the soup?
An hour at most. Fish cooks fast. They say it needs to reach 60 degrees Celsius to be ready, to be safe to eat. We'll peel the potatoes now. Rinse them and put them in. They'll be cooking while we're preparing the fish. By the time we add the fish, the potatoes will be nearly done.
So is the water boiled now, Constantine?
Beginning to boil. You need a teaspoon of salt per 3-litre pot. I've just the right amount here.
And I've heard there's a Russian saying that if you add too much salt to the water, it means that you've fallen in love with someone.
Yes. There's also this saying that not enough salt is on the table while too much salt is on your back, which means you're going to sweat a lot if you eat too much salt. I've packed a wooden spoon.
Is it tastier with a wooden spoon?
It's not that it's tastier, it just doesn't get as hot as a metal one. When you spoon hot ucha cooking over the campfire, a metal spoon can burn your lips. A wooden spoon is still hot, but not to that extent. Wood doesn't conduct heat as well as metal. Let's stir it. Let's see. Is it time to add the fish? So much smoke. You can't make ucha without smoke. Here we go. We'll rinse this later. That's it. Go slow. This fish is small. It won't take long.
How long will it take to cook, do you think?
Well, about 10 minutes. Not long. The water's boiling already.
Yeah.
Yes, the head as well. Heads make the broth thicker and more savory. As the saying goes, a pike's head is an empty babble. But still, heads are useful for making ucha.
Mm-hmm. It adds flavour.
Yes, it adds flavour.
It's very wholesome. And you can taste the onion as well. What does the north mean to you, Constantine?
For starters, this is my home. My home country, taiga and fishing. I've lived my whole life here.
It's a place where the soul rests, as they say. There's no other way to put it. You feel it no matter where you go or what you do.
To me, the north is the place where you can reconnect with your roots and really feel ties to your country, your culture, your nature, and your origins as a whole. A village in the north is where you can learn how to communicate with other human beings, understand and accept them. It's a place where you can grow spiritually and become a better version of yourself.
Everything good is the north. People here in the village are like family. We're all very close to one another.
The north is my home. I'm sure this place will leave a mark on my soul, too. You will go away but leave a piece of your heart here in the north, which will urge you to return.
You're from the Russian north. What does the north mean to you?
For me, it's the people. They are a very special kind of people. And again, if we're talking about Kinozora, these are also very special, unique people. And that's what's important to us, to preserve our cultural and natural heritage, but above all, to preserve its people. This unity of culture, nature, and man, that's the essence of the Russian North.